WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a few minutes, you're going to hear one of the missing parts of a now classic book of fiction, Native Son, Richard Wright's 1940 novel about a young and brutal black man coming of age in a Chicago slum. This novel is taught in many schools, has influenced many writers, especially African-American writers, but key scenes about the main character's sexual life were deleted at the request of the Book of the Month Club, which was interested in offering the book, but only if it were toned down. Wright agreed to the changes, and Native Son became the first bestseller by an African-American writer. Now those excised passages are restored in a new edition of Native Son, just published by the Library of America. It's part of a two-volume set of Wright's works, which also includes a restored version of his autobiography, Black Boy. My guest, Arnold Rampersad, edited and notated these new editions. Rampersad is also the author of a recent biography of Langston Hughes, and he's the director of the American Studies Program at Princeton University. I'll let Rampersad sum up the impact of Wright and Native Son on American culture.
Never before had one of America's greatest problems, some would say the greatest problem, the problem of race and understanding of race and race relations and so on, never before had it been addressed in as bold and as probably illuminating a way. On the other hand, Wright wrote more than Native Son, and I think if you add up all the work, the autobiography, Black Boy, other pieces of fiction, his essays and also his travel books on highly critical travel books on Spain, for example, or Africa, as in Black Power. When you add it up all together, you have the work of a very, very committed writer, committed to representing reality as he saw it, no matter who was offended by it, either black Americans or white Americans. And with a keen eye for philosophical and political and cultural issues that are still as important to us now as they were with him. So I think it all adds up to his being an extremely important writer.
I want to ask you, for our listeners who have never read Native Son, to just describe what the book is about.
The book is set in the south side of Chicago, and it opens with an alarm clock ringing in a tenement. Bigger Thomas lives there with his family under pretty horrible conditions. Bigger is estranged from his family, fights with his siblings and his mother, goes off to what is to be his latest job, which is to be a chauffeur in a white household, a very wealthy white household. And on his first day on the job, as it were, he meets the daughter of the household, Mary Dalton, and her communist boyfriend. And pretty soon, Bigger Thomas finds himself in Mary Dalton's room. Her mother comes into the room. He cannot admit that he's in the room, because in the context of the 1930s and of his imagination about where black people are supposed to be, black men in particular in relationship to white women, he is forced to try and conceal the fact that he's in the room. Her mother, by the way, is blind. And he smothers Mary Dalton, and she dies, and he cuts up the body and pops her into the stove, or the oven, I guess you'd call it, and that sets him on the way to a subsequent murder of his black girlfriend, to be pursued for a trial in which his communist lawyer will go up against the district attorney in a long, extended, drawn-out debate about many things, politics, race, and so on. At the end of that, Wright is not Wright, but Bigger Thomas has come to some better understanding of himself, some greater sense, clearer sense of his own identity. He admits to what he has done that is wrong, and in that admission, he achieves the first stage, if you like, in what I think Wright hopes is his move towards dignity. Ironically, of course, it comes as he's about to go to the the to be executed, right?
What is the most important scene that was cut from the book?
Well, I think there are two or three that are extremely important. I mean, the scene in which before meeting Mary Dalton, Bigger Thomas is in a movie house looking at Mary Dalton in a newsreel, cavorting with other debutante types on the beach, with an announcer leering at her in a highly sexual way. In other words, with Mary Dalton being held up in the very American way as a kind of sexual commodity, as an opportunity for Bigger Thomas to indulge his imagination in, well, I think what we might call either natural or also natural and perverse ways that had been forced upon him by the very marginal and curtailed life he had been forced to lead. There's a scene also where Bigger and a friend masturbate in a movie house. What we have there, I think, right, showing is the extent to which questions of race shaded over very quickly into questions of sexuality, and how, in the case of this novel, they came to a point, as it were, in Bigger Thomas's relationship to Mary Dalton, which, of course, is brief and fatal for Mary Dalton and ultimately for Bigger Thomas.
Let me ask you to read one of the scenes that was deleted in the original edition and has been finally reinstated in this new edition of Native Son. And this is early on in the book. It's a scene where Bigger Thomas and his friend go to a movie theater. And it's the scene we were referring to, where they masturbate in the theater.
They walked along the street in the morning sunshine. They waited leisurely at corners for cars to pass. It was not that they feared cars, but they had plenty of time. They reached South Parkway smoking freshly lit cigarettes. "I'd like to see a movie," Bigger said. "Trader Horn's running again at the Regal. They're bringing a lot of old pictures back. How much is it?" 25 cents, okay, let's see it." They walked six blocks in silence. It was 11:30 when they reached 47th Street in South Parkway, and the Regal was just opening. They bought tickets and walked into the darkened movie and took seats. The picture had not yet started, and they sat listening to the pipe organ playing low and soft. Bigger moved restlessly, and his breath quickened. He looked around in the shadows to see if any attendant was there, then slouched far down in his seat. He glanced at Jack and saw that Jack was watching him out of the corners of his eyes. They both laughed. "You at it again?" Jack asked. "I'm polishing my nightstick," Bigger said. They giggled. "I'll beat you," Jack said. "Go to hell." The organ played for a long moment on a single note, then died away. "I'll bet you ain't even hard yet," Jack whispered. "I'm getting hard. Mine's like a rod," Jack said with intense pride. "I wish I had Bessie here now," Bigger said. "I could make old Clara moan now." They sighed. "I believe that woman who passed saw us. So what? If she comes back, I'll throw it in her. You a killer. If she saw it, she'd faint. Or grab it, maybe. Yeah." Bigger saw Jack lean forward and stretch out his legs rigidly. "You gone? Yeah. You pull out fast." Again they were silent. Then Bigger leaned forward, breathing hard. "I'm gone. God damn." They sat still for 5 minutes, slumped down in their seats. Finally, they straightened. "I don't know where to put my feet now," Bigger said, laughing. "Let's take another seat." "Okay." They moved to other seats. The organ still played. Now and then they glanced back up to the projector's room high in the rear of the theater. They were impatient for the picture to start. When they spoke again, their voices were throaty, drawling, tinged with uneasiness. "You reckon it'll go all right?" Bigger asked. "Maybe. I'd just as soon go to jail as take that relief job." "Don't say that. I don't give a damn. Let's think about how we'll do it, not about how we'll get caught." "Scared?" "Oh, no." They listened to the pipe organ. It was humming so low that it could scarcely be heard. There were times when it seemed to stop altogether. Then it would surge forth again, mellow, nostalgic, sweet. "We better take our guns this time," Bigger said. Okay, but we gotta be careful. We don't want to kill nobody. Yeah, but I'll feel safer with a gun this time. Gee, I wish it was three now. I wish it was over. Me too. The organ stopped and the screen flashed with the rhythm of moving shadows. Bigger sat looking at the first picture. It was a newsreel. As the scenes unfolded, his interest was caught and he leaned forward. He saw images of smiling, dark-haired white girls lolling on the gleaming sands of a beach. The background was a stretch of sparkling water. Palm trees stood near and far. The voice of the commentator ran with the movement of the film. Here are the daughters of the rich taking sun baths in the sands of Florida. This little collection of debutantes represents over $4 billion of America's wealth and over 50 of America's leading families. Some babies, Jack said. Yeah, man. I'd like to be there. You can, Bigger said, but you'd be hanging from a tree like a bunch of bananas. They laughed softly and easily, listening to the commentator's voice. The scene shifted to and fro over the glittering sands. Then Bigger saw in close-up the figure of a slight, smiling white girl whose waist was encircled by the arms of a man. He heard the commentator's voice. Mary Dalton, daughter of Chicago's Henry Dalton, 4605 Drexel Boulevard, shocks society by spurning the boys of LaSalle Street and the Gold Coast and accepting the attentions of a well-known radical while on her recent winter vacations in Florida. The close-up showed the smiling girl kissing the man, who lifted her up and swung her round from the camera. Say, Jack, huh? That gal there, in that guy's arms. That's the daughter of the guy I'm going to work for. They lived at 4605 Drexel. That's where I'm going to go tonight to see about that job. For real? Sure. The close-up faded, and the next scene showed only the girl's legs running over the sparkling sands. They were followed by the legs of the man running in pursuit. The words droned on. Ha! He's after her! There! He's got her! Oh, boy! Don't you wish you were down here in Florida? The close-up faded, and another came, showing two pairs of legs standing close together. Oh, boy! Said the voice. Slowly the girl's legs strained upward until only the tips of her toes touched the sand. Ah, the naughty rich! There was a slow fade-out while the commentator's voice ran on. Shortly after a scene like this, shocked Mama and Papa Dalton summoned Mary home by wire from her winter vacation and denounced her communist friend. Say, Jack, yeah? What's a communist? Damn if I know. It's a race of people who live in Russia, ain't it?
Well, I must compliment you on your reading. It was a wonderful reading.
Thank you.
Now, how do you think that reinstating this scene into Native Son changes how we read the book?
What they do is they provide what has been for a long time, I guess, since 1940, a kind of puzzle, the last piece in a puzzle about Bigger Thomas. I mean, he's always seemed, I think, to critics, a strangely limited person, a kind of automaton almost. Wright wanted to show that sex was an absolutely indispensable part of the whole discussion concerning race. Not about 3 years before Native Son appeared, you had William Faulkner in Absalom, offering us his fictional meditation on the question of race, is most profound and most intricate. And there again, I mean, Faulkner understood very clearly that you cannot talk seriously about race in this country without also talking about sex. And to take a character and to strip away a central character like Bigger Thomas and to strip away his sexual feelings is to reduce him to something that is almost incomprehensible. And, of course, there's also the element of a warning And Wright was walking a pretty fine line there. I mean, there had been many accusations about black men leading to all kinds of lynchings and stereotypes and so on. Yet still, he was determined to risk the danger of being misunderstood, of having been seen as creating another kind of stereotype by making Bigger as sexual a being as he did intend to make him. To take that away is really just to make Bigger less than human.
My guest is Arnold Rampersad, who edited and notated new editions of the works of Richard Wright, including a restored edition of Native Son. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arnold Rampersad, editor of a new two-volume set of the works of Richard Wright.
One of the pieces of Wright's that you've republished is a really fascinating essay from 1940 called How Bigger Was Born, and it's Wright's explanation of how he created this character and all the kind of intellectual thought that went behind creating this character, who is, you know, hardly an intellectual, someone who's always acting on instinct, not on intellect. Do you think that the novel was at all misunderstood in its time? I mean, if anybody would have presumed that Richard Wright was more like Bigger Thomas as opposed to the intellectual that he really was?
Well, I think the response was definitely complicated. It is said that Book of the Month Club buyers in 1940, many of them assumed that they were buying a murder mystery, and then they discovered it was not that at all. There was a mystery and there was a murder, but there were at least two killings, but it was not whodunit. So that's one way in which I think the book was misunderstood. Lots of people felt that Wright had betrayed the race. I mean, there was both pride at Wright having achieved his national reputation with his book in the black community, but also a sense that he had emphasized some of the least attractive aspects of the culture, even though he was also at the same time emphasizing the horrors of segregation and racism. The book has been seen as advertising a kind of cultural nationalist position, and has been seen as exactly the opposite, a place in which Wright works out some of his hostilities against the black community. So I think that it stands there in the way major texts inevitably stand, capable of multiple interpretations, especially as our own reality changes historically, the culture's reality changes, and we see the work in a different way because it continues to speak with many voices on a variety of issues.
You know, Richard Wright in this essay expresses his concern that he knew that some people in the black middle and professional classes would accuse him of creating a character that wasn't representative of what black people were really like, just representative of a minority. And he also knew that a lot of white racists could read this book and say, see, we told you, this is what black people are like. But he decided not to censor himself. You know, and I'm thinking what a contemporary dilemma this was. I mean, he wrote this essay in 1940. The book was published, you know, the novel was published in 1940. But even today, people are so concerned that they're not going to be able, that they're not going to be creating positive role models in their fiction. And they're often criticized for that.
Yes, for Richard Wright, there was almost no problem. He was, from the beginning, so you can call it either alienated from both the black and the white communities of his native South, or so dedicated to telling the truth that there's virtually no ambivalence in his writing. 1937, he published an essay called Blueprint for Negro Writing, in which at the beginning he dismisses virtually all black writing before his own time as being essentially obsequious, black writers curtsying before white public opinion, seeking favors. And he was determined that he would not write in that way, but would write regardless of the reaction in the black community or the white community, so long as he satisfied himself that he had told the truth. And And I think that he stuck by those guns to the very end of his life. He was, I think bravery was perhaps the most notable aspect of his face, if you like. He deeply admired H.L. Mencken, and in fact traces his real growth as a writer to coming across in the South while he is growing up, while he's still quite young, coming across the words of H.L. Mencken and learning from Mencken how to use, quote, words as weapons. Mencken, the great iconoclastic journalist. And I think that's the way Wright saw writing as a kind of warfare, almost a warfare with the forces of ignorance, intolerance, bigotry.
At the end of Native Son, when Bigger Thomas is about to be executed, he's in his cell with his lawyer, Max. And Max is trying to get Bigger to think about what he felt that led to the murders. And Max is trying to make social connections. And Bigger Thomas says, "I didn't want to kill, but what I killed for, I am. What I killed for must have been good. When a man kills, it's for something. I didn't know that I was really alive in this world until I felt things hard enough to kill for them." And the lawyer's eyes are full of terror after Bigger Thomas says that. What does that passage mean to you?
Well, I wish I knew exactly. I mean, I suppose I should know what it means to me. But I've never been certain I understand completely what it means. One thing it could mean is that Max, as with what one might call, I don't think it's the most accurate description of his ideological quality, one might call him a liberal, is seeing a level of dehumanization in an individual that he had no idea existed previously, that somebody could be so elementary in his sense of himself that it takes an act of murder for him to begin to feel alive and to define himself in terms of guilt and blame and not in any kind of positive sense. Max is horrified to know that such a person exists, and I think Max is also well aware that there are thousands and thousands of Bigger Thomases who kill no one but who have that same rudimentary sense of themselves as human beings, and I think that is what Max recoils from, and the whole idea of defining yourself in terms of your crime. It's Dostoevsky, but Max is not prepared to find it in America. But there it is, and that's what Wright wants to point to, that the problem is as serious as that.
Arnold Rampersad, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad edited and notated the new 2-volume set of the works of Richard Wright, published by the Library of America. Rampersad directs the American Studies program at Princeton University. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air.